Weird Al was having fun with a Michael Jackson song when he penned, or unpenned, Eat It. But for many women and men, eating disorders are no joke. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
At what point does finicky eating become an eating disorder? How much of an eating disorder is mental? Is there a tipping point beyond which the sufferer can no longer control the urge to binge or fast? What's the best way for family and friends to support a person with an eating disorder? Why would men be vulnerable to eating disorders? Our guest is Ted Weltzien, director of the Eating Disorder Service at Rogers Memorial Hospital.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we all eat, so when does eating become a disorder?
Well, that's a good question. I think from an eating disorder standpoint, it is one of the few illnesses where actually normal behavior does lead into the illness. So typically, 90% of people who develop eating disorders start out with healthy, really, intentions, whether it's related to eating in a more healthy fashion, cutting what they would call dessert or snack or foods with fat in them, or increasing their exercise. And of course, we all do this. And if everybody who went on a diet developed an eating disorder, there would be a lot of eating disorders around. But of course, that's not the case. But the real curious thing about it is that for a certain small subset of the population, what turns out as typically a diet that may be successful or may not be successful turns into one of really two characteristics of disordered eating. One is anorexia, which is restricting to a very severe point and developing an illness that has a 10% mortality rate, or binge eating, either bulimia or binge eating disorder, where people starve themselves to the point of really being out of control with their hunger and then overeat and then either compensate for that by trying to fast or get rid of the food somehow, or simply happen to what most people who have unsuccessful diets is binge eat and gain weight. So that is really a very interesting question, is what determines who makes that shift.
You used an interesting word early on there, and that was people start out with good intentions, and that implies that this is a matter of a conscious choice on their part rather than something that even more subconsciously or even physiologically kicks in.
Well, I would liken it to, say, other activities that people – I mean, typically, because this affects young people, I think that one of the things that happens is that if you don't really educate people about healthy nutrition or give them experience around eating and they start getting into extremes of nutrition, then they really don't have the so-called experience to draw on to figure out if they're getting into trouble or not. And I'd liken that to underage drinking, where obviously, not to say that that's well-intentioned, but it is, you know, many people would argue it's kind of a normal part of growing up, certain amount of experimentation. And yet there are those people, though that small percentage of people, who will say at the first taste of alcohol, they knew they had a problem. And so I think that the well-intentioned aspect of it, just some vignettes would be someone who is being teased or feeling left out at school and decides that, you know, I'm going to do something. I'm going to change my appearance. Or someone whose father has a heart attack And they are becoming increasingly anxious about the story they read about the genetics of heart disease. And they're saying, well, I need to do something about my eating. So that's what I mean when I say well-intentioned. It's really usually trying to do something that they interpret or perceive as positive.
One difference seems to be with alcohol or with tobacco, you can cut that out of your life. In other words, you could go cold turkey, and you can't do that with food. We all have to eat, which makes it even more of a trouble. How do you distinguish, though, between a problem of just obesity, which is obviously epidemic level in this country, being obese, and having an eating disorder?
Obesity we don't define as an eating disorder. Obviously, it's a nutritional metabolic state that could be accounted for a number of different things. But studies suggest that about 25% of people who are obese have a defined eating disorder that is characterized by binge eating or a lack of control, overeating, and using research to kind of work out the criteria, these people would fit into a diagnosed eating disorder, what we call eating disorder not otherwise specified. So the question is, what is different between the 25% who have binge eating disorder and the 75% who don't? And it seems to be the key thing is a feeling out of control with your eating, so that you are unable to do what you think you should do, which is eat normally, go to see a registered dietitian, work on developing a healthy meal plan. But you can't do that because you can't control your eating and your eating gets out of control. So, you know, I think that seems to be the big difference for that population. And the studies also suggest that for people who are overweight and have binge eating disorder, until they deal with the binge eating disorder, then attempts at improving their nutritional state or their metabolic state are not going to be very effective.
If we look at the pie chart of eating disorders, that we've been talking mostly about people eating too much, but there's, of course, the other side, too, those who don't eat enough and are in danger of dying from it, really. In terms of a pie chart, if we're looking at percentages in the overall phenomenon of eating disorders, how do they break down?
Well, anorexia nervosa, which is characterized by a lack of food intake, being underweight, as defined by typically 85% of what would be an average height for weight in a non-obese population. And so typically if you're 5'4", you're about 20 pounds underweight and very noticeably underweight. And there's a certain amount of biological things that go on at that point. Studies suggest that women with anorexia, when they're underweight, have about a 10% reduction in brain size. They lose their menstrual periods. They have high risk of osteoporosis. Some studies might suggest they're at increased risk for heart disease. And so they have this really abnormal nutritional state. But then they have a whole set of cognitive symptoms that are really distorted. I mean, what we call incorrect thoughts. For example, I don't need to eat and nothing bad will happen to me. And I could go on and on about the extreme nature of how distorted this thinking is. But it clearly is distorted. People really don't see the problem.
That's a direct result of, in effect, starving the brain, reducing the size of it?
Exactly. I mean,
So you couldn't just reason with people like
you
that.
Cannot, no. And in fact, studies when I was at the University of Pittsburgh, one of the groups of researchers at that point were looking at systematically cognitive functioning in people with anorexia and clearly demonstrated that their ability to engage in abstract reasoning, you know, which kind of involves stepping back and seeing the big picture, that's what they lose, and that as they gain weight in the absence of, you know, nothing else, that they gain back that abstract reasoning. And that's really where you have this physiological, biological thing going on, which makes treatment very difficult. But back to your question, which is, you know, about anorexia is the most commonly probably recognized, but it's the rarest eating disorder we have. It's roughly 10% of eating disorder patients have anorexia, but they tend to be a lot more noticeable. You see the people who are walking down the street who are very underweight. Oftentimes you see people running down the side of the road. And these people also are in the hospital the most. So in terms of kind of the contact, if you work in eating disorders, you have a lot more contact with people with anorexia. But if you were to look at the population in general, it represents about 10%. Bulimia is much more common, but people are much more able to kind of conceal that behavior.
There are a lot of high-profile cases, whether it's Princess Diana and the bulimia or various, you know, supermodel actress types with anorexia. But I understand that your work, some of it is with males and eating disorders. If you look at that pie chart again in terms of gender, eating disorders, how is the breakdown in terms of males and females?
I mean, the conventional belief has been that 10% of eating disorder patients are men. You have to recognize, or I mean, one of the things that we have to be aware of is there aren't really any good systematic prevalence studies for eating disorders. So that just hasn't been done. So most of these kind of guesses are what that is. They're guesses. But generally speaking, you know, I would say 10, 15, some people will say 20% of men. But my guess is that 10 to 15% is probably a real accurate representation of what population. So if you look at if we focus just on anorexia and bulimia in this country, you're talking about roughly 1 to 2 million men who have an eating disorder and roughly 8 to 10 million women who have a current either anorexia or bulimia that meets diagnostic criteria.
Do you think we have a sort of stereotype about who has these disorders? In other words, are we focusing mostly on the young women, gymnasts or models or whatever, and missing how widespread it is throughout the population?
Well, I think that we have to recognize there's been a transition in our society in terms of the value placed on weight and shape and unrealistic expectations. And so 20 years ago, if you look – I mean the high-risk professions or behaviors or athletics, were clearly – you know, it was reasonable to expect them to occur more frequently at that point. What's happened in women is that now everybody values having, you know, low body fat and you know, that to be happy you have to be thin. And so, you know, I think that we've seen a lot more of it generalize outside of these high-risk type settings. And the same thing is happening with men as well, is that historically, when men were first recognized as having eating disorders, the characteristic person was either someone who was gay, someone who was either in gymnastics or modeling, or someone who was really psychiatrically ill, you know. And so to be a man who had an eating disorder, there had to be something else really wrong with you. And what's happened with more understanding is that that's done two things. One is it's kept people from getting treatment because they did not want to somehow be labeled, you know, as someone who has a personality disorder or
stigma.
But it also has really made it very difficult for people to recognize men with eating disorders. And so when we say, you know, it's 10 to 20%, we really don't know, because men are much less likely to come in for treatment. And parents are much less likely to bring their kids into treatment, because I mean, I can't tell you how many times a parent has said, you know, if my son has an eating disorder, does that mean he's gay? Well, you know, it's like, well, you know, I mean, but that's the perception. And so, I mean, you can, you know, so it's not something you're going to be really looking at and saying, gee, you know, this is great. So it's something that as you get further away from that picture that looks normal to you, the less likely you are to see it. And that happens in kids. People who are below the age of 12 or prepubertal boys and girls develop eating disorders. There's been an increase in eating disorders in middle-aged women who are, you know, now getting the message that, you know, 60 isn't 50 anymore, it's 40.
Right.
And,
you can still fix yourself
up. Clothes that people are wearing at that age are much different than they were. And so that's this kind of cultural, societal pressure that makes people desperate. And then a certain – or I shouldn't say people, but a certain small percentage of people somehow get desperate about it and then get into these extreme behaviors.
Now, is it an eating disorder also if a person uses food as a substitute for affection or anything else, and in a fit of depression or ongoing depression just simply eats and doesn't care if he or she gets overweight?
Well, we wouldn't call that an eating disorder, but it's really a good way of thinking about eating disorders, because, for example, depression, we know appetite disturbances go along with depression. So a certain percentage of people with depression will lose a lot of weight. And then, interestingly, in women with depression, about 50% will overeat as a symptom of their depression. But when you treat the depression, the eating goes away. And you don't have this focus on the intense, distorted thinking about body weight and shape. And so that's a lot of times people will kind of be misdiagnosed as having an eating disorder and have this untreated depression. And the way I think about eating disorders is the flip side. It's like you have the eating problem and the associated depression. So that, for example, 75% of people who have binge eating either or bulimia nervosa have a diagnosable depression. About 3/4 of those without any medication. With simply treating their eating disorder, the depression goes away. And so, you know, it's kind of this almost flip sides of the coin. You know, one you have the mood disturbance predominating, and the other one you have the eating and the nutritional stuff predominating.
Which is the cause and which is the effect.
Right. And if you can target the cause and go after that, things work a little bit better. So, you know.
I would think that it would be related to obsessions and compulsions too.
Well, yes. Historically, people, because of what I was just talking about in terms of this mood-eating connection, people historically or probably about 20 years ago decided that it was really intuitively the case that depression and eating disorders were really connected and that eating disorders were really a certain variant of depression. And a lot of work was done with that and just turned out not to be the case. But after that, a number of years after that, people started getting interested in anxiety disorders and eating disorders. And what they have found is that for anorexia in particular, that obsessive-compulsive disorder, perfectionism, obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, certain temperamental traits about people who tend to what we call harm avoidance and low novelty seeking people. In other words, the people who don't like to do things spontaneously or take chances, people who tend to be much more controlled, that these people, that those traits and those illnesses tend to occur at a much greater than expected frequency in people with anorexia nervosa. And so, in fact, at Rogers, we have one of the only programs that treats people with comorbid OCD and anorexia and bulimia for that matter. And so there seems to be a connection there that's much stronger scientifically. Doesn't make quite as much sense kind of intuitively because, you know, you would think people who are perfectionistic don't want to be sick. You know, I mean, so.
Well,
but,
that's one way of looking at it, isn't it?
But you would think that people with obsessive thoughts or, you know, where you can't get a thought out of your head or you're just really focused on one thing, it does seem as if it would correlate with being obsessed with not eating too much or eating.
Right. And people, yeah, and I'm certainly not an expert in the kind of the neurobiology of OCD, but I think that the perfectionism is part of it. The tendency to get locked into behaviors, you know, kind of it's like the song that you can't get out of your head or the symptom that perpetuates itself. I think that my experience is that a lot of people with eating disorders have started out with the OCD that has nothing to do with eating disorders, and then all of a sudden the obsessions and the compulsions are all about food and weight. And so, you know, maybe there's some wiring in there that is along the same lines. Probably there is. It's still not quite sorted out.
We're going to look at some of the risk factors and other causes of eating disorders when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
You're listening to University of the Air, and as you enjoy more talk today, please take a moment to support what you care about, the programming on Wisconsin Public Radio. More programming and less on-air fundraising means your support is more important now than ever. 888-202-2552 or online at WPR.org. That's 888-202-2552. And thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Dr. Theodore Weltzien, and our topic is eating disorders. We've mentioned a couple of familiar names of these disorders, anorexia and bulimia, and I gather there are some others too, but we haven't really defined them yet. So how would you characterize each of those disorders that we've been discussing?
anorexia nervosa, which has been referred to in the medical literature for 1,000 years, is characterized by a lack of eating or what we call restrictive eating or fasting that isn't defined by a lack of food or some other medical condition. It's a willful refusal to eat and results in a loss of body weight down to below typically 85% of average body weight for height, which is important because that is a period, a time where you see the physiological changes associated with malnutrition. And so what you have is then this low body weight, you have these physiological symptoms of malnutrition. Typically in women, you have a loss of menstrual period. In men, you have low testosterone, and you have a variety of other things. But those are kind of the key thing. The sex hormones like estrogen and testosterone are low, resulting in dysfunction. And then the other important aspect is that you have a refusal to gain weight so that if someone says, hey, you know, you need to gain weight, the person will refuse to gain weight and has no insight into that. They deny the seriousness of it, including the fact that they might die. That is what is required for anorexia nervosa. It's important, obviously, in anybody who's losing weight to make sure they don't have something else going on. So a comprehensive medical assessment is essential in making that diagnosis. The second eating disorder is bulimia nervosa, which was first described in the medical literature in 1979. Hasn't been around that long in terms of the awareness in the medical community, but has been around for many more years than that. But we really don't know how long in terms of the criteria we use for bulimia. Bulimia is characterized by abnormal nutritional behavior, in this case, episodic binge eating. And that is described as eating a large amount of food in a short amount of time and feeling out of control. Typically, it's dessert and snack type foods, typically foods that people would not want to eat or see as bad. And typically, someone would be on a diet eating very healthy food, quote unquote, and then would binge on pizza or ice cream or cookies or things like that. Now, bulimia nervosa is characterized by compensatory behavior, which, of course, we can all identify with. Oh, I overate. I got to do something about it. Well, you know, doing something about it might be, well, I'm going to maybe not overeat the next day. But people with bulimia get into extremes. And so the most typical thing is self-induced vomiting, which is gagging oneself and causing themselves to throw up. And that is predominantly the compensatory behavior that is used for bulimia. Now, other ones are also used. People will use laxatives, which really scientifically don't do a lot.
Because at that point, it's already...
Right. Your bowel's very effective at absorbing food. But the idea is that if you use a laxative, it increases the transit time. What happens, though, is that what you're really losing is water more than anything, and people are developing really severe dehydration, and which can be very medically dangerous. Other types of things, people will use diuretics, they'll fast, they will exercise, and those are the typical compensatory behaviors. But the self-induced vomiting is the most common.
And what's the damage done there?
Well, the damage is significant. I mean, obviously, you can cause significant gastrointestinal problems. Some people have speculated increased risk for esophageal cancers because of this regurgitation. Dental enamel is eroded, and all kinds of other things that, you know, your body is just going through this. And people, to meet criteria for bulimia nervosa, you need to binge and purge at least twice a week for a 6-month period. But average, you know, it's not uncommon to see people who binge and purge 2 to 3 times a day for years. And so this...
2 or 3 times a day?
2 or 3 times a day.
For years.
Yeah. And, I mean, and you to really understand how out of control this eating is, it's something that is really impressive. When I was at the University of Pittsburgh, we actually had a laboratory set up to really try and see, you know, is it really true what people report that they eat, they actually eat? Because it was enormous amounts. People would sit down and eat 2 large pizzas and describe this. And so we actually did a study where we put people in the lab and we had the record amount of food consumed in 24 hours was 40,000 calories.
Wow.
40,000 calories.
Right. And, you know, and what this is just 24 hours of eating and throwing up. Now, that's obviously at the extreme, but this is out of control behavior, and people really have an intense panic if they're not able to purge or really have a real craving to engage in this.
We know that the Romans used to do something along those lines of eating and throwing up deliberately in order to enjoy more food. I mean, that wouldn't exactly be bulimia, but it was the same sort of pattern, right?
Right. And I think, I don't know if my recollection is they had specific vomitoriums as well for the behavior engaged in this. I mean, this is it was a culturally defined behavior, but the symptom that people with bulimia have that the Romans presumably don't have is similar to anorexia, this overvaluation of weight and shape. So that the reason that they're getting rid of the food is that they are in intense panic about the effects of that eating, that they cannot tolerate the thought of gaining weight, that it is so important for them to lose weight, to be thin, to get the food out, that they have to engage in this behavior. And it's not because their friend's doing it. It's not because they even care about what other people think about what they look like. It's what they are perceiving. And so that's the second real important symptom in bulimia, is this overvaluation of weight and shape that's really driving the behavior. So these two disorders are very simple to kind of diagnose in a sense once you get people to really tell you what's going on. Now, the third diagnostic category is what we call eating disorders not otherwise specified, which people always kind of have a problem with. Well, what is that? And one example we could use, which isn't a great example, but it would be to say, well, you have three categories in chemical dependency. You have alcohol abuse, you have heroin addiction, and then you have these 500 other substances that people use. Well, in chemical dependency, we have benzodiazepine addiction, we have stimulant addiction, we have 10,000 other diagnoses. Whereas in eating disorders, we don't diagnose laxative abuse or diuretic abuse or exercise addictions or things. What we say is that, okay, if you have a nutritional problem that is associated with extreme behaviors and is associated with either being underweight, out of control eating and overvaluation of food, weight, and shape, then that's an eating disorder in the absence of something else. And it has to be severe enough to be really causing a problem. And so, for example, you know, I mentioned binge eating disorder where you have episodic binge eating, out of control eating. So that's one. Another example would be someone, say, who's had gastric bypass surgery who vomits 10 times a day, but her weight or his weight technically isn't within that range that's anorexic. I mean, no one would say they don't have an eating disorder. And, you know, and the surgeons or the gastroenterologists have said, look, this isn't physical. Or the person who has to exercise, has to run 10 miles a day before they can eat anything.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, too. And you do run into that,
right?
People who are really compulsive, obsessive exercisers.
Right. But there are a certain group of those who it's linked to food and it's linked to weight, and they have to compensate for eating or exercise to allow themselves to eat. And these are the people that aren't going to be real great at a dinner party. These are the people that are very difficult to live with. And, you know, it's not an uncommon situation, you know, where they kind of get into this behavior that's very nutritionally driven. Even though it looks like exercise, it really relates to nutrition and concern about weight and looking at your abdomen and making sure, particularly in men, this is an issue that you see because men are focusing in on their body fat, their six-pack abs,
yes,
and you know, and this type of thing. So that's really where you need people expert in the area of eating disorders, because these are the people that are really going to be missed the most because they don't really, you know, we miss anorexia and bulimia, but the eating disorder not otherwise specified, which is as severe, no less severe than the anorexia and bulimia, is a little bit more difficult to really kind of characterize.
What about people who eat the wrong thing or just only can eat a certain thing or have such an extreme – I mean, we all know about the
fad diet,
vegan diet, but something that's even more extreme where you – are just scared of certain foods, or
well,
that's a disorder too.
In you know, the distinction is an overvaluation of weight and shape. So, for example, there's a disorder called body dysmorphic disorder, you know, where people have this distorted perception of a part of their body. That is not an eating disorder. I mean, it could be their stomach even, and they could not eat, but it doesn't have to do with weight or shape. It just has to do with the distortion in their stomach. Obsessive compulsive disorder, we talked about this earlier, but people who may have certain OCD symptoms around going to the bathroom, which aren't uncommon, will not eat because then they avoid, you know, if you don't eat, you don't go to the bathroom.
You avoid voiding.
You avoid, exactly. And now that, you know, that is clearly a disordered eating, but it's not an eating disorder. And so that's really where the distinction where, you know, and this is important from a treatment standpoint too, because all eating disorder treatment ultimately has to focus on that distorted thinking about food, weight, and shape. I mean, and so if you're trying to treat someone and you're focusing on distortions around food, weight, and shape, but they don't have any distortions on food, weight, and shape, they have disordered eating for other reasons, the treatment is not going to be effective.
I would think that one difference between anorexia and bulimia and maybe some of those non-specified disorders would be the element of secrecy. Somebody who's anorexic, it's pretty clear that there's something going on. Whether it's clear to them or not, it's clear to everyone else. But it seems to me that a bulimic and some of the others maybe lead these double lives that must have another psychological dimension to them.
Many people with anorexia have no shame or guilt about their illness. Their only problem is that other people think they need to gain weight, and that just doesn't fit with their view of things. And so they may conceal things to avoid that issue, but they're not doing it because they're afraid of being discovered. People with bulimia typically are very shameful. They see binge eating and purging as really a loss of control, as being weak in some ways, because ultimately they start out by trying to restrict and be in control and eat healthy and, you know, exercise, but for some reason can't. So they conceal it for two reasons. One is they recognize it's abnormal, which people with anorexia don't. And the other one is that they feel bad about it themselves. So they want to hide it. It's hiding it from themselves. It's that sense of denial. And that's really a big part of the treatment, because one of the things about bulimia is that what starts out as a concern about what you eat or nutritional stuff ultimately becomes a way of managing your emotions. And all of a sudden, what used to be, I need to get rid of this food because I overate and it happens once a week or once every couple weeks, all of a sudden, I had a bad day or I've got a study tonight and I'm anxious, and you start using this for your emotional stuff. Well, you know, if to get better, you need to deal with shame and guilt, then you have to kind of ask yourself to deal with what exactly you haven't dealt with for 5 years. And so that's really why it is so difficult, why the treatment is such a monumental thing for people, is that it's not just dealing with anxiety about weight or nutrition. It's all of a sudden having to deal with this emotional distress that they've been avoiding for 5 years, let's say. I personally admire people who recover from eating disorders, because I've worked with this group for 20 plus years, and it's always impressive to me how difficult, how challenging it is for someone really to kind of give it up, because it's, you know, like you say, I mean, you have to eat, so
yes,
you're giving up
you
a
can't
symptom
go
of saying,
cold
right,
turkey.
Right. And then you're giving up your best friend in terms of how you deal with a bad day, and then you feel bad about yourself at the same time. I always say people who to recover from an eating disorder is to have tools in your emotional toolbox that no one else has. I mean, you just have to have gone.
What do you do at Thanksgiving? What do you do at Christmas, right, when everybody else is eating all this stuff and it really is great?
Yeah.
Is
exactly.
This exclusively a human problem? In other words, so much of this seems to be guilt, shame, concepts, and so on. Or do you find, especially with animal model studies and so on, that animals can show evidence of
the animal model studies have not been anywhere near as effective as, say, the chemical dependency ones. So there is something, there is this environmental thing that is setting the stage for something that ultimately comes pretty biologically reinforced. So I mean, there are better biological models for excessive exercise, for obesity. But bulimic behavior is not something that kind of works as well.
Do animals actually – are there animals – I've heard that horses, for example, if you just somehow turn them loose in a barn full of oats, they'll never know when to stop until they fall over dead. I don't know if that's true. But
yeah,
are there cases of that sort of thing in the animal kingdom?
Well, I would assume that there are. I mean, I'm not aware of anything that, you know, has kind of been linked to eating disorders. And I think the reason is that from a treatment standpoint, If you take someone with bulimia and get them to eat normally, they lose their desire to binge eat. You know, I think that there have been a famous study done with conscientious objectors of the Korean War called the Keyes study from Minnesota. Took people and starved – these were, I believe, all men, certainly predominantly men – starved them to the point of being anorexic in terms of their weight. And they did things like collect you know, they became obsessed with food, basically. They collected recipes.
It's reasonable.
I mean, and
but we've all been in that situation to some degree or another.
Right. And the other thing they did, though, is that when they started to give them food, they would overeat. They would get out of control with their eating. And I think that there are certain human conditions where people overeat. There's neurological conditions where people overeat. I mean, we've seen very rarely people with brain tumors who present as people with eating disorders, but there's, you know, a part of their appetite control center is being somehow affected. But the key symptom for bulimia and overeating is starving yourself and really screwing up your hunger and fullness centers of your brain.
And you literally are tinkering with your brain.
Exactly.
And is there a genetic link? In other words, is a woman with anorexia likely to have a child that will show that? And is that where I suppose that gets into the nature-nurture debate too?
Well, actually, the genetics of eating disorders are pretty strong in terms of if you have a first-degree relative with an eating disorder, your chances of developing an eating disorder are significantly greater than the general population. And that's been shown in fairly elegant twin studies done in Scandinavia with very good records and people living in separate environments. So I would say that the evidence for a genetic vulnerability is really overwhelmingly strong. It's obviously not like a lot of other genetic vulnerabilities. It doesn't mean you're going to develop the illness, but it does make sense when you see someone whose mother had anorexia or a father had anorexia or bulimia, and that happens. And we use that really to kind of help demystify this and try to educate people that this is not something that people need to be ashamed of. I mean, it's like some people are at risk for diabetes and heart disease and other things. And so, I mean, this happens to be one of those things that people are at risk for.
We'll see what you can do about it. How can you handle or help a friend or loved one handle an eating disorder? When we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Theodore Weltzien, and we are talking about eating disorders. I'm guessing that each of us has somebody we know with an eating disorder. And one of the hardest things can be watching a relative or a friend or an acquaintance engage in destructive behavior and not know what to do about it. What would you say to someone listening who knows someone that seems to have anorexia or bulimia and wants to know what to do?
I would intervene. They have reality shows now about intervention and stuff like this. Not that I'm suggesting that, but I think that, you know, I mean, you should do something for a couple of reasons. One is, as I said, the death rate, the mortality rate with anorexia is 10%. Bulimia nervosa is characterized by greatly increased risk of depression and depression-related consequences like suicidal behavior and chemical dependency in its own right. So to do nothing is kind of leaving a ticking time bomb. The average duration of illness for an eating disorder is 5 years. So if you do nothing, then the chances are that you've got 5 years of doing nothing, and maybe the person will recover. So it really is important to do something. And the other thing that about eating disorders are they're quite expensive to treat once they get severe. So the earlier you intervene, the more likely you are to benefit from a community-based, typically less expensive type of treatment. And so once someone develops an eating disorder, some studies suggest that the average cost of treatment for what would be optimal treatment is $100,000, which
wow.
You know, is a lot of money. So you know, so it's letting it sit is not a good idea because you're bringing in all kinds of things that you would hopefully want to avoid. And then the question is, well, the biggest question I get is, well, how do I know? I mean, well, what should I say? And I kind of liken that to I don't think eating disorders and chemical dependency have a lot in common, but I think that they do have certain things in common. And I think that we all feel a lot more comfortable with what's the threshold to question someone's drinking, or whether we question them or not, we know there's a problem. And so I think with eating disorders, I think that if there is a concern, there's more than likely a problem. If there's a problem, it could be a disorder. There's no reason not to bring it up. And the other thing about bringing it up is that, well, what's wrong with bringing up a concern about one's nutritional status or how their relationship with food or their relationship with emotions? I mean, this is all part of being healthy. So I would say there should be a low threshold for bringing it up. And the thing you want to do is you want to bring it up based on your concerns. You don't want to criticize someone or accuse someone. You want to come across as a person who is concerned based on what you're seeing. And you want to talk to them at a time when you think they're going to be most receptive. So you don't talk to them when they're coming out of the bathroom after dinner red-eyed and you're concerned that they went and threw up again. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. That's not the time to talk about to them. So you want to kind of say, okay, I there's something really important I'd like to talk to you about. And then you go through and express your concern. Yeah, you say that you care about them and you really want them to get help and you want them to go seek help with this person. You want to have them go get evaluated by someone.
But isn't there a flaw in that if this person is already to the point where he or she has lost their cognitive abilities because of the condition?
Well, what I would say is that we're intervening early. And so if their brain hasn't shrunk 10% yet, maybe it's shrunk 3%. You know, we're trying to speak to that healthy part of the brain.
Well, what are your recourses once it gets to the 10% point? Let's say it's an adult, legally responsible for him or herself. What kind of recourse do you have to force that person, as it were, into the hospital or into some kind of treatment?
It takes a lot of time to develop the relationship and the setting for someone to accept help if they're that far along. And so it could be, you know, a spouse saying you need to get help or else. It could be typically what happens is someone has a medical complication. They pass out at work, mm-hmm. end up in the emergency room, and the cat's out of the bag, you know, and they've been concealing it forever. So once it's out of the bag, then the majority of people really do seek help. I mean, the interesting thing about people with eating disorders is that there's always a part of them, for the most part, who want to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and a friend of mine, a colleague, doesn't call them resistant. He doesn't like the word resistant. He calls them reluctant, and that they're reluctant for some reason. And so you want to talk with them about what is that reason. And usually it has to do with distorted thinking. So the more they are their own agent in life, the more you want to get them hooked up with someone they can develop a good relationship, typically a therapist, have a supportive doctor who can monitor them and get them to that from that pre-contemplative to that contemplative to that action stage. And you know, the stages of change is very applicable here, and educating people about that is very applicable, and get them to say, you know, you're not the only one who has this problem who doesn't want to get help. And that's a normal part of this. So let's work together on that. So with the younger people, typically adolescents, getting the family involved, because, you know, if they're part of a family unit and if they're part of a healthy family unit, then a lot of really exciting recent research suggests that if you can take that family and work with them in a productive way, that they can create a milieu or a kind of a setting for that person to get better. And people may or may not have heard of this. It's called the family-based therapy, developed at the Maudsley in London. And so that's something when you are not an adult and other people do have the ability to have some control, particularly with anorexia. I mean, that's a really exciting new treatment. So you're trying to develop an environment that is helping these people recover. Kids with intact families, you really want them involved. And we don't see the family as the problem. We see them as part of the solution. As people get older, and then it has to do with, you know, really feeling out who they feel comfortable talking with them, getting them to really start to reflect on the choices that they can make and do that. And now The majority of that actually happens in an outpatient setting. I mean, there are a number of people who need to go inpatient. I mean, at Rogers, we do a lot of 24-hour residential inpatient treatment. I mean, that's certainly a small percentage of people who need care, and we're used to kind of probably more resistance than you see. But, you know, these people are wanting – I mean, I'm always amazed by that kernel of reason. Sometimes it takes a while to kind of for that to grow. And then the reason you want people seen by people who have some familiarity with eating disorders is that while they're deciding to get better, you don't want something bad to happen psychiatrically or medically. So you want to make sure that there's a little bit of an envelope of safety so they aren't getting too underweight or their electrolytes aren't getting too screwed up or they aren't going to put themselves in some catastrophic medical situation or – because of the increased rates of depression and suicidal behavior, you have to have that addressed as well. So that's why a lot of people don't like working with people with eating disorders, because it's nutritional, it's neurobiological, it's families, it's
psychological,
you know, it's reluctant patients, it's dealing with other part of the team in terms of medical and dental and insurance. I mean, so the people I think who kind of like working this like to work with other people and kind of that team type approach.
So at what point can you take – I'll start with a person with anorexia, that kind of person, and have them eat their way out of the problem. At what point do you have to use some kind of a treatment that would involve drugs?
Well, you know, usually – actually drugs is not the first intervention that, you know, you would kind of impose on someone, because there are no FDA-approved drugs for the treatment of anorexia nervosa.
Or bulimia?
Bulimia, there's one FDA-approved drug for the treatment of bulimia nervosa. So what you actually – the interventions that required are basically to take the control of eating away from them in a supportive way to support them nutritionally – until their brain starts working a little better when they can take it back.
Are you talking about IV feeding? Or
well, people will – what we call nasogastric tube feeding. Sometimes people have what's called total parenteral nutrition, which goes intravenously. Those are the two most common ways of providing that nutritional support. And that's something that, amazingly enough, frequently – people will somewhat reluctantly agree to, but they kind of recognize that, you know, they can't do it on their own. It's interesting that a lot of times it is they don't feel as guilty about eating if they kind of give that control up to someone else. I mean, they may panic about it. So it may seem really kind of cruel, but working with people, if you have a relationship with them, I mean, they kind of recognize that, you know, this is something that is helpful, and then they start thinking a little bit better. They know that you want them to take the control of eating when they're ready for it. And so, you know, it's one of those things we have to do.
I would think if you're trying to work on people's cognitive part to get them to think differently, it must feel frustrating when you can't change cultural imagery. You can't change the anatomical distortions of the Barbie doll or some of the things that are out there. To what extent do you see sort of culture itself, Western culture, as the culprit?
Well, I mean, statistically, it definitely is a big part of the problem, because we are bombarded with unrealistic expectations all the time, you know, whether it's how much money we should have or what car we should drive or how much alcohol we should drink or how much whatever. I mean, people are trying to sell products to us that have nothing to do with our sense of well-being. The rates of eating disorders are the highest in Western cultures, with these distorted messages that link body, weight, and shape to happiness, relationships, all those things that, you know, we're told we should have.
Being valued and respected by one's peers.
Exactly. And so I think life has gotten a lot more complex. I mean, you know, certainly over my years, I mean, the amount of information that kids have to deal with, the uncertainty, the gender roles. I think the reason males may be more susceptible at this is it's healthy to have a cultural, have more accepted diversity in terms of gender. But one of the problems is for men is that they now have to react to that and define themselves in a much less I would say, and studies have looked at this, things are much less predictable and sure. I think that's a good thing, but it leads a certain, you know, it requires guys to be more predictable. You could say the same thing about women also. But I think that's where it's one of the complexities where you say, well, how am I going to be happy? How am I going to feel good about myself? And, you know, and so these younger people and probably people my age as well are susceptible to kind of making these desperate choices if we're desperate. And that's why I like to say that eating disorders on some level is a desperate choice for a desperate person about food, weight, or shape. And so I think the culture is at play here, but it still doesn't answer why do some people, why does that relatively small percent of people really go on and develop the disorder, whereas everybody else really doesn't.
Our guest this hour has been Dr. Theodore Weltzien, and he's at Rogers Memorial Hospital. He's the director of the Eating Disorder Service at Rogers Memorial Hospital. Thanks for joining us for this illuminating hour.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.
Thank you for listening to University of the Air on Wisconsin Public Radio and for making it possible with your financial support. University of the Air is partly funded by listeners like you. Most of our important source of revenue for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from listeners. Please take a moment to support what you care about, University of the Air and the programming of Wisconsin Public Radio. More programming and less on-air fundraising means your support is more important now than ever. Call 888-202-2552. Or pledge online at WPR.org. That's 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. Thank you for your support and listening to University of the Air.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, we'll have a good look at the Great Lakes. How healthy are they? And how have they changed since the Erie Canal? Next Sunday afternoon at 4, University of the Air here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.